cars, three kids, six phones, a whole lot of confusion up here in my home. 500 stations on the TV screen, 500 versions of the same old thing. Y'all know it's crazy, and it's driving me insane. Well, I don't wanna be a Superman, I just wanna go somewhere, use my hand to keep it simple. Oh, real simple. You know, I call my doctor on the telephone. The lines were open, but there was nobody home. Press one, press two, press pound, press three. Why can't somebody just pick up the phone and talk to me? Y'all know it's crazy. You know it's driving me insane. I don't want to be a Superman, I just go somewhere, use my hand, and keep it simple.
That's really good advice. You just keep it simple. Keep it simple. That's my main man, Keb Mo. Actually, his name, his name is actually Kevin Moore, but his drummer, his trusted drummer, kept calling him Keb Mo. So that's his professional name, Keb Mo. Keb Mo comes from that part of the Delta where people say police, singular, and police as plural, as in one police, but two police. Hello, this is Eutrice Lead. You're listening to Lead Stories right here on PRN.FM. It is Monday, October the 28th. And we'll be talking about two things today. In the second half of our program, we'll discuss the enlightenment of 14 prominent African-American church leaders who, because of their devotion to God, are compelled to support Obamacare. But first, we'll be talking about my favorite couple, the favorite co-presidents of the United States, Bill and Hillary Clinton, who have taken a special interest in a gubernatorial race in Virginia. And there's a reason. You see, the race is now boiled down to three people, one of whom was the bag man for the Clintons. He was their money man. Even loaned them money to buy their house in New York State when Sister Hillary was getting ready to declare herself and to have herself declared the U.S. Senator from the state of New York right out of the White House. And so he had raised a lot of money. He was former chairman of the Democratic National Committee, and he was a precedent setter in the way he raised money, very, very extraordinary at it. So he's one of the candidates, as is Kenneth Cuccinelli, a Republican, who, as it turns out, was the first. He's the standing state attorney general of the state of the state of Virginia, and was the first to file a lawsuit against Obamacare among his many so-called strong points in this election. And then we have Robert Christopher Sarvis, who is a young man who tried and failed in his bid in 2011 for a state seat in the state Senate, and who is running this time around in the gubernatorial race on the Libertarian Party line. Here's what's interesting about this race. When people were given a choice in a Quinnipiac poll some time ago, I think this was either May or June, I remember. The two leading candidates were McAuliffe and Cuccinelli. 40% of the people said they wished that somebody else were running. And we had the Charlottesville area poll conducted by the University of Virginia showing that 36% of people were undecided at that time. Of course, 1 week away from the November 5th election, we have a narrowing of that gap. And even so, Sarvis, the third party candidate, had scored at least 10%. He was doing quite well, even though he was independent. And the view was that the closer to the election, with people really dissatisfied with having to pick between Cuccinelli and McAuliffe, they may just go for Sarvis. So he did stand a chance, at least in the eyes of the public, to garner some attention. But you see, this is a really interesting thing. In come the Clintons, because they have to now back up their money man. They have to return the favor and back him up. So Sister Hillary was out there early in the game. She decided on, I think it was October the 19th, she came in, broke a five-year silence of campaigning. She actually stayed out of campaigning since she was considered a member of the cabinet of Barack Obama's cabinet and had not done campaigning until October the 19th when she came in to support good old Terry. And then, of course, over the weekend, Bill Clinton hit up the black communities in a strong way and going to bat for Terry McAuliffe, denouncing the Republican candidate Cuccinelli to make it almost a slam dunk for McAuliffe. Why? Because the turnout is expected to be low, as it usually is in off-presidential year election. In the by-elections, you find that the turnout generally is low. And they're counting that even if it's low, it would better McAuliffe's chances. The media hasn't helped any. And what they did was, in a debate, they decided to lock out Sarvis, the third party candidate, and basically made it a two candidate choice. Here is an interesting thing that developed with this particular incident, because in locking out Sarvis, they said that Sarvis did not fully qualify under the terms of the host for the debates between the candidates, and that was WDBJ in Virginia. Here's how they explained locking Sarvis out.
Virginia's governor's race will not include Libertarian candidate Robert Sarvis. Today was the deadline for a decision, and the candidate's recent showing in polls came in just below the level he needed to receive an invitation. WDBJ 7 is televising the October 24th debate at Virginia Tech, and today we announced the event will include Republican Ken Cuccinelli and Democrat Terry McAuliffe. Political reporter Joe DeShiel is here with more on the decision.
Chris, the threshold was 10% in the major independent polls of the last 3 weeks. The agreement with the Cuccinelli and McAuliffe campaigns said the decision would rely heavily on an average of major polls tracked by the website Real Clear Politics. Though Robert Sarvis had polled above 10% in some recent surveys, the average came in at 9% on today's deadline.
Whenever I meet voters throughout Virginia, they're just elated that they have a third choice. And so it'd be a real tragedy for voters not to be able to see me in front of the audience with the other two candidates.
When we spoke with Robert Sarvis earlier this week, he was hoping to be included. He said the debate with Ken Cuccinelli and Terry McAuliffe was one of the few opportunities he would have for an extended discussion in front of a large audience, showing the clear contrast between the candidates. We also asked for his reaction if the invitation didn't come.
Well, disappointment, but we'll carry on. I generally don't let that get me down. I'm traveling around the state regardless and, going to as many events and meet and greets and trying to get myself in front of as many voters as possible. And it's a lot of fun.
In a statement this afternoon, WDBJ 7 said the decision comes 2 weeks before the debate to give the candidates and debate organizers enough time to prepare. So even if Sarvis were to climb in the polls over the next 2 weeks, he will not be invited to participate in the debate. Joe DeShiel, WDBJ 7.
All right.
Well, there you go. So the television station hosting the debates decided that he was not Sarvis. The third party candidate, the Libertarian candidate, is not going to be part of the debates, giving Virginians basically a choice. And the choice is the Republican candidate or the Democratic candidate. And in a field where if they had to choose between the Democratic candidate and the Republican candidate, we did have a poll that said that they would have preferred somebody else running other than those two. So what does this mean? It means that, and I'm talking about this in terms of how African-Americans, Latinos, and other Bloc votes could leverage their political clout. Here's a very good example. But before we go on to how this could have been accomplished, let's listen to Sarvis's wife, who is a pediatrician, Astrid Sarvis. She's an African American, and she decided to take this matter to YouTube. And she published a very moving and very passionate plea to the voters of Virginia. Here's what she had to say.
Hi, my name is Astrid Sarvis, and I am the wife of Robert Sarvis, who's the Libertarian candidate for governor of Virginia. I never thought I'd do something like this. I am a pretty private person and fairly apolitical. But when we got the news on Thursday that my husband would be excluded from the final debate before the election, I have to say that my emotions went from shock and disappointment to sadness. Sadness because, first of all, I was there to see my husband's initial reaction, but I also felt sad because I felt like I'd personally let so many people down, all the people that I met out in Virginia that were inspired by our campaign. Then at some point, I started to feel resentment because I, as well as everyone else involved, knew that it was unfair that my husband had been excluded from the debate, despite earning the right to be on the ballot and being on the ballot for months up to that point. But you know what? We carried on anyway. We had a meet and greet in Williamsburg that following Friday, as well as another meet and greet in Newport News that Saturday. And, you know, getting out there and seeing people and talking to them and seeing how inspired they are, it really helps get you out of your funk. Rob gets all the tough questions. I have a lot of conversations with people, but usually the nature of them is a little bit different. We talk a lot about how am I able to balance being a mom and a wife in addition to having a fairly difficult job, although I will say in all honesty that being a mom is much harder. And then you throw in there, you know, that my husband's running for governor of Virginia, so people really want to know, how do you do it all? But one of the questions that we both get asked is whether or not Rob's going to be in the debate. Is he going to be in the debate? And with people knowing that the final debate is October 24th, a lot of questions came up after we found out that he would be excluded. And, you know, prior to Thursday, we were able to say with some certainty to people that, you know, yes, there was a good chance that Rob would be in the debate. Although at that point, all we knew was 10%. We didn't know, you know, if that meant 10% in one poll, 10% in most polls, 10% in recent polls, or as we eventually found out, like everyone else, the day that it was told to us by the host, an average of 10%. So even though we didn't have that information, we felt comfortable telling people that there was a good chance. And, you know, having to then talk to people after finding out was very, very difficult. And we felt comfortable because, A, look at the events surrounding the debate. There is so much apathy and dislike for the other two candidates, frankly. So that's one thing. But also, the other thing that made us almost certain that he would be in the debate is this. This is something that I put together, and I hope that you can see it. But this is just sort of to give you a visual of Rob's polling numbers. And, you know, that's 12, 10, 8. And as you can see, although there was a fluctuation in the numbers, and this is from the beginning, and then this is most recent, although there's a fluctuation in the numbers, the two things I'd like to point out was that he was at or above 10% in about half of the polls. But as you can also see, the trend was always upward. And I'll just point out that, you know, I did not manually construct this at all. I put the numbers into the Excel software and it did the rest. So what you're seeing, both the graph and the trend lines, are accurate. So given that, and given the overall attitude among voters about this election, we thought surely he would be in the debate. And surely, you know, it would be undeniably clear that this is something that Virginians deserved. So I have to say that getting out there and having to explain to people that, in fact, he had been excluded from the debate was very difficult. We actually got a visitor at our house. She was a nice lady, and she came with her son, who's a senior in high school, and they were outside of our house for 10 to 15 minutes. I was wearing earphones because the kids were asleep, and I didn't want to wake them up. And at some point, I heard them, and I was a little bit startled, but I went out, and there they were. And I felt really bad that they had been out there for 10 to 15 minutes, and we talked for quite a while. But her son is a senior in high school, as I said, and they were there for door hangers and palm cards so that he can distribute them in his neighborhood in Fairfax City. She asked me whether or not Rob would be included in the debate, as well as many other people that following weekend. And so I have to say that it was not just seeing my husband's initial reaction, a man that, to his very core, is nothing. I'm sorry. Is nothing but honest and fair, and was therefore completely caught off guard by being excluded from the debate. But it wasn't just his reaction, but the reaction and the look on those people's faces that I met. Both the woman that visited our house with her son, as well as the people that we met in Williamsburg and Newport News when we had to tell them that, in fact, we'd recently found out that we were excluded. The look on those people's faces, as well as my reflection on my own life experiences and how this reminded me of so many things, that is what compelled me to pick up my iPad and record this video, because although I am way outside my comfort zone right now, I feel obligated to the people of Virginia in the exact same way that I feel obligated to that impoverished community that I grew up in that I'll tell you about. In the same way that I feel obligated to my patients right now. And I'll just say that this is not meant to be some contrived political move. I'm in my room right now by myself with my iPad. Neither Rob or anyone else in the campaign helped me say what I'm saying in this video.
Well, there you go. A very serious lesson learned about the ravenous nature of politics. And when people see an advantage to lock you out or do you in, they'll do exactly that. So here we have a three-way race. As Astrid Sarvis says, the attitude of the people in Virginia is that they would prefer neither of these candidates were running. If there was somebody else running, and the somebody else is her husband, Robert Sarvis. But the media locked him out, saying that he did not, for some technical reason, did not meet the 10% threshold. And, of course, she disputes that. She has her graph, and she shows that on a consistent level, he was building. He had either met the 10% threshold or had gone beyond the 10% threshold. But in any event, the decision was made, he's out. He's out of the realm of consideration as far as the voters are concerned because the media took him out and decided that the race is now Republican versus Democrat. All right, so now we have the Republicans trying to come in. Rand Paul, I think, one of the other top Republicans are coming in behind Cuccinelli. And we have the Clintons, both barrels blazing, coming into town. Now, the Democrats, we made clear, people are disenchanted with the Democratic Party. They're disenchanted with the Republican Party. But the Clintons roll into town because it's about money. They see a real possibility that their bad guy, their bag man, their money man, who, like the Clintons, was the center of several scandals, many, many scandals involving money. But the one thing that he is good at is raising money. He's fantastic at raising money. He raised more than $263 million for the Clintons. He's a big money guy. Big, big, big money. So they come into town in this with this possibility that with the competition, the likely go-to guy, which is a third-party guy, Bob Sarvis, with him diminished in terms of media coverage, and with the advantage of the Republican Party being positioned in the national media as a party responsible for the shutdown in Washington, even their own questionable candidate could do very well. So they come into town. And where does Clinton go? And this is a lesson for the African American community. Who do you think they are just betting on to bring this thing home for McAuliffe? It's the black community. They go to the black community and they try to dig out a vote. And they're working hard at it. Very, very hard at it. All bets are on McAuliffe winning. It's interesting because it is where Barack Obama started his campaign and ended his campaign. In these same territories that the Clintons are working. And it was these two particular areas, Hampton, Richmond, Prince William's County, that delivered a very strong black vote. So you see where we go for this. You see how it works? And this is why I say the African-American community in particular, as it relates to the Democratic Party, there is no consciousness in the African-American community about just how valuable their vote really is. Everybody understands it but them. What is it? In the scenario in Virginia, it's a fantastic textbook case of the African-American vote being in the absolutely wonderful position of leveraging their own vote and going with the other guy. The best strategy here would have been to go with Sarvis. Dump McAuliffe. Dump the Republican Cuccinelli. Go with Sarvis. That would have been the smart thing to do. But they have no political direction. They have no political cohesiveness. They are so much on the plantation, the Democratic Party plantation, they can't even see what is happening, even as it's happening. The Clintons are coming because it's about money, and black folks are going to keep them and their guy in money. And I'm not just making this money thing up. McAuliffe himself said he's about money. He makes no bones about that. He's gotten very wealthy being in politics, and this is a signature characteristic of Clintonites. It's not about public service and all that high-minded business. It's about making money. It's money, money, money. And that's why they are all over the place trying to dig out every black vote possible, because whites see through this. They have options. They have options. Blacks are acting like they have no options. And this is what I'm saying. This is why we want to watch this case, this particular race, I should say. It's very instructive. I believe strongly that McAuliffe will emerge as the candidate. He will emerge as governor. He doesn't deserve it. He isn't qualified for it, really. But the Clintons, who have no regard at all for ethics, will, and because they have an obligation to this man, you know, that's the way their circle works. It's all about money, money, money. And our current president is exactly of the same mindset. It's about money. Big money. And they're looking to score the gubernatorial spot in Virginia to further enhance their ability to use political office specifically in order to make money. The rest of all that stuff, you know, could go to heck for all they care. That's not what they're there for. They're not there to serve any altruistic need, any lofty idea. So here's an instance in which if the African-American vote were astute, if the voters were astute, they would do one of two things, either not vote, which is a very good strategy, by the way, or go for Mr. Sarvis, go for the third party candidate, and never, ever, ever find themselves in the Democratic Party ever again. They're being used. We'll take this break, and I'll come back to the flip side, the other side of being used, this time by the preachers of the Lord. Yes, stay tuned right after these messages. Lord, hit me, hit me, hit me.
You
You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we're talking about black folks getting used and abused by the Democratic Party. Well, part two of this discussion takes us to a group of 14 prominent national African-American leaders of varying denominations, Christian denominations, making it plain that they stand in firm support of the president and their commitment to Obamacare. On the same day, in fact, that the president was in the Rose Garden dealing mostly with thorns, over the debacle that Obamacare has become, they issued this letter that reads in part, "We believe that access to quality health care is a fundamental civil and human right in America. Historically, over 7 million African Americans have been uninsured and denied access to care with devastating consequences. The Affordable Care Act provides African Americans, along with Americans of all nationalities, access to desperately needed quality health care. We affirm our support for the Affordable Care Act. We understand that over time, aspects of the Act will be revised as government learns more, and to be expected administrative glitches will be appropriately addressed, but it is essential that we work aggressively with what we have right now. We cannot afford to put this off any longer. Any further delay will have catastrophic effects on the nation's uninsured." And it continues. "We, the leaders of predominantly African-American denominations and other faith leaders who lead millions of African-American people of faith, believe that our devotion to God requires us to be actively involved in promoting the well-being of all people. In some cases, we can best accomplish that objective by executing clearly defined, focused, collaborative efforts among denominations and other faith-based groups. We believe in those cases we can accomplish more together than we can separately. The issue of providing all Americans with access to quality health care is one of those issues." And their commitment includes, they say they will commit to facilitate the critical enrollment numbers necessary to ensure the success of the Affordable Care Act and seek other opportunities to work toward improving the health status of our constituencies, such as health and wellness Sundays, which will include thematic preaching on specified Sundays along with other related activities. We call on all others of like minds and empathetic hearts to join in this public affirmation by affixing your name to this historic document." Well, who are these folks? Let me read you. You may recognize some of them, but they include the Reverend Dr. Otis Moss, Jr., Chair of the Faith Partnerships, Inc., the Reverend Dr. Barbara Williams Skinner, co-chair of the National African American Clergy Network, who, by the way, is heading this effort, the Reverend Dr. T. DeWitt Smith, Jr., co-chair of the National African American Clergy Network, the Reverend Dr. Carol A. Baltimore, president of the Progressive National Baptist Convention, Inc., Bishop George E. Battle, Jr., senior bishop of the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church, Bishop Charles Edward Blake, Sr., presiding bishop and chief apostle of the Church of God in Christ, Inc., Bishop John R. Bryant, senior bishop of the African Methodist Episcopal Church, the Reverend Dr. Susan Johnson Cook, founding president of the Women in Ministry International, Bishop Paul A. G. Stewart, Sr., acting senior bishop of the Christian Methodist Episcopal Church, Bishop Paul S. Morton, International Presiding Bishop of the Full Gospel Baptist Church Fellowship International, the Reverend Dr. Julius R. Scruggs, President of the National Baptist Convention USA, Inc., the Reverend Al Sharpton, President of the National Action Network, the Reverend Dr. Stephen Thurston, President of the National Baptist Convention of America, Inc., and the Reverend Dr. C.T. Vivian, President of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. These are some heavy hitters. These are big names. And they command the attention of millions of African Americans in the United, in this endeavor, united, as they say, in this firm support of Obamacare. Now, I have great respect for the church. I think it has played the institution of the church has played a great role in liberation struggles, historically speaking, but in recent years, not so much. I wouldn't mind if these ministers and church leaders were similarly public about what has not happened for the millions of their followers in this administration in terms of an agenda. But as it regards Obamacare, I was hoping to see evidence that they actually have read the document and know what it says. Instead, they go with this, they go with the concept as verbalized by the president and his cronies. This is what it will do. In fact, the president keeps calling it a good product, a product. Healthcare is a good product, says none other than the president, talking like a real snake oil salesman. It's a good product. And I am willing to bet you that of all these 14 prominent national religious leaders, if I were to run a pop quiz on any one of them to tell me whether they have actually read the 2,700 pages of this document, let alone the 33,000 pages of its regulations, whether they know what this is, whether they know how it got passed, whether they know about its constitutionality, and whether they really believe in good conscience as the devout people that they are, that they could truly say that they have made an educated choice and therefore are doing the right thing by advising the millions of African Americans who would be listening to them and would probably take their advice. But I'm more inclined to believe that what is going on here is just plain old Democratic Party politics and folks who either are unwilling or unable to leave the political plantation. They are still immersed in plantation politics and tied to the Democratic Party like an umbilical cord. One such minister who gained the attention of Michelle Obama in particular comes from Mississippi. His name is Reverend Michael Miner, and he has a small church. It's about 100 people or so, as Reuters describes it, the Oak Hill Missionary Baptist Church in Hernando, Mississippi. It's in the Delta region. That is to say, it is in the poorest region in the United States. And guess what? He has a grant, $317,742 to encourage the sign up. You go out there and sign up these black folks. Tell them what a great thing this is. And you just go out there and sign them up. And that he will do. He has announced that he will be organizing a group of some 41 or 42 churches in the region as navigators, as they're called. These are navigators. These are people who will help enroll you. They'll help you navigate the church system that still can't operate. But they will navigate you into Obamacare. And after that navigation, you're on your own. They have done their job. But he, as a small church with 100 members, he received a grant of $317,742. This is how it works. The leaders are bought, and they are bought to bring along their congregations. And this is the kind of incestuous relationship that a certain segment of our supposedly spiritual and religious leaders have forged with the Democratic Party. We will be your errands. We will be your ambassadors. We will be the people who will bring the people to you. We will tell them what to believe. You just tell us what you want them to believe and we'll make it happen. Not one of these people, I am willing to bet, has actually read the bill, the law. Not one of them. And that's what we have for leadership, folks. So whether it is the Clintons operating in their typical shady political style, nobody ever introduces Bill Clinton as the impeached president. They still think he's been able to divest himself of the stench, him and his co-president, Hillary. They've begun to enjoy once again the warm glow of the lights of the media. People don't even recall Whitewater. They don't recall any of at least 20 to 30 different scandals that the Clintons have been part of. But they all recognize one thing, and this is the thing that I wish the African American community could understand. They all are pimping the black community. They all go to it. They all just like, you know, that if you ever watch the voracious appetite in a gold mine, they have these huge pieces of equipment that just are wheels with sharp edges turning and turning and just, you know, just eating into the soil, trying to find gold or whatever it is they're digging for. But they just scoop up the dirt because they're after the precious thing. That's what these people do. And that is why the double duty of African-American voters, Latino voters, and plain voters anyway, just plain voters, any voters, who had sympathetic ties with the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, you need to revisit your rationale for that kind of a relationship and change it. But especially for the African American community, you're still on the plantation and you have black overseers. They send them out to you to bring you in, not because they love you, not because they care about you, not because they feel a sense of duty to uplift and protect, but because there's money in it, there's status in it, but mostly there's money in it. You think anybody could come to the average white community? You think Bill Clinton could go and just talk smack to white voters? Would he do that? Not at all. He's at Virginia Tech today, I think at 2 o'clock, with his favorite candidate. He'll be talking serious business as to why McAuliffe should be the guy. For black folks, all he needs to say is, hey, you know me, I play the saxophone, you remember? Yeah, I'm your brother from another mother. And that gets him the vote. So we need to really think about these things. We really need to see how, in so many ways, you have to be defensive, you have to be cautious, you have to be suspicious of all of these folks because they have motives. And the one motive they have, whether it's Republican, Democrat, or whoever, but especially these sleazy Democrats, the sleazy Republicans we know, but the sleazy Democrats we give a kind of pass to, because for some reason they're supposed to be the better party. No, they're not. They're sleazy. And this is how they use people. President Obama is doing it. The Clintons do it, preachers do it, and leaders do it. The black vote, the black people don't care about the black vote. Just show up and do as we tell you, and then you could disappear again, because certainly we will. We have no further use for you, so we'll be taking care of our business. We just need you at particular times to operate like lemmings. Just show up, pull the lever, and then disappear. We'll get to you eventually, if you force us. Well, I have time to take one, at least one or two calls at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. We have a couple of minutes left. We can sneak a call in. Don't forget, tomorrow it is open forum, so we have a lot to discuss tomorrow. But I thought I'd bring this to your attention because, you know, we have to kind of look at these things from an entirely different perspective and be automatically suspicious, because the media, they're all working together. There's a synergy of effort going on here. They all agree you don't belong at the nexus of power. You are already consigned to the periphery. Don't get ambitious to try to get to the center of it. You're not that worthy. But you are valuable because you enable the people in power or people of power to do exactly what they want to do. You give them license, and this is how they do it. This is how they do it. Well, you're on the air. Sarah, how are you?
Great.
Hello.
Utrecht, can you hear me?
Yes.
I'm sorry, Utrecht, my phone. Okay, Utrecht, I'm so glad that you're talking about this, because you had me over here fuming, because I was going to save this for my Free My Mind on tomorrow, but I'm going to save part of it today. You see, this is why I have no faith in these black leadership, especially these religious types that runs around here, because here it is, this man, as you just said, here it is, this man. And he has the right name. His name is Minor, because he is a damn minor. With 100 members, got this money, and running around the county telling people to sign. These people there seem to forget what happened with the Tuskegee experiment, what happened to black people who were used as so-called the first set of lab rats for these people to test their experiments on, before these medical experiments, before it was implemented worldwide. You don't have no medical degree. Most of them are ignorant as you know, all get out. And you're going to be trying to tell your people to sign up for this just because there's a black face pushing this policy in the White House with a cute wife and a nice family. You're going to try and tell your members to sign up for something that you don't know jack about? This is what we have masquerading as leadership in our community, Utrecht. This is why we need to totally, we need to run these people out on a rail. These people, they need to be gone.
Well, I mean, it is part of the consciousness, I think, the political consciousness of the African-American community, because way too often, this is the dynamic. People are not spoken directly to. Leaders don't speak directly to the people. They speak to the intermediaries. You handle it. Because these are the people who they place in positions of control and influence.
Yeah.
And, you know, and but I'm saying at some point I could see that is a worthy thing. But I have not seen any evidence that people have actually read this thing.
Utrecht, they have not. They have not. All they have seen is, this is President Obama. We don't want him to be a failure. We're going to do anything at all costs, even if it means sacrificing ourselves on the altar in order to make sure this first black president, that he is a success. We don't care what he do. We don't care if he come up with a Hitler genocide plan to put us all in a gas chamber. He's black. He has a cute family. We want him to be a success. So therefore, we're going to do whatever is put before us. That is how they're operating.
Well, I just am amazed that these are the opportunities just the same for the community to wake up and make other choices, decide to go a different route, decide that you are fully empowered, you're fully capable of making your own decisions. And when people stand in the way as the intermediaries, somehow of all voters, the African American community has to be told, really, how to vote. No.
You see, Utrecht, I'm going to say this and get offline. I called into a show on last week, and I told this individual this because he was mentored by Dr. C.T. Vivian, and I told him, I said, Dr. C.T. Vivian has been bought out. He's given this Presidential Medal of Freedom. He's on his way to D.C. I think he's supposed to be pinning it on him sometime either this week or sometime in November. He's getting this medal. He is just like Joseph Lowery, John Lewis, all of them who get these rewards from this president. And what happened? It stuffed their mouth. It blinded their eyes, and they don't see. He said, oh, no. Dr. Vivian, he's not a sellout. He's not going to sell out. Now here it is. He's one of these coalitions running around here pushing this health care bill. Don't know if from this man is over 80, almost pushing 90. Don't even know Jack. And here it is. He's running around here. You see, I'm going to call him back. I'm going to tell him, I said, I told you so. I told you that he was being pushed and used because he's the strongest proponent out here. He's one of those from Dr. King era that they feel that they have to bend him like they bend Joseph Lowery.
Well, I'll tell you one good thing about Joseph Lowery. Joseph Lowery has made it really clear that the Obama administration has a lot to do with respect to the needs of the African American community. He's made that very clear, very, very clear. Well, thank you, Sarah, for calling.
You're so welcome, Utrecht.
Thanks. Thanks a lot. Well, tomorrow again, we do have open forum, so we can pick up the conversation there and other issues because there are many that we didn't tackle today. So we'll have more than enough to talk about tomorrow. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Richard Martin with Wake Up Call. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories, that's LEID, Stories with Utrecht Lead. Take care.
Bones. A whole lot of confusion up here in my home.